From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Charles Lindbergh was one of the first mass media celebrities. He became a hero in 1927 after making the first transatlantic flight. He became a victim in 1932 when his infant son was kidnapped and killed. During the era of World War II, he was perceived as a villain by those who interpreted his comments as anti-Semitic. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with A. Scott Berg about his new biography of Lindbergh. Berg was the first person to be given access to Lindbergh's papers. And we'll hear from Lindbergh's youngest child, Reeve. She's just written a memoir. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The initial airing of President Clinton's videotaped testimony before a federal grand jury is now more than half over, and viewers nationwide have seen Mr. Clinton go through a range of emotions, including frequent bitterness at how the Paula Jones sexual harassment lawsuit precipitated independent counsel Kenneth Starr's investigation of the Monica Lewinsky matter. NPR's Neil Conan is monitoring the broadcast, and he has this update. We'll have that report for you in just a moment.
The camera shows President Clinton alone in the White House map room. His attorneys and lawyers from the independent counsel's office are off screen. The president says repeatedly that he is embarrassed by his inappropriate relationship with Monica Lewinsky and takes full responsibility for it. After their last sexual encounter, he said he was sickened by what he had done and vowed it would not happen again. In this part of the tape, the president responds testily to questions about his testimony in the Paula Jones case. Pressed on whether he had provided the complete truth, the president said the Jones lawyers were trying to set him up.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful. I did not wish to do the work of the Jones lawyers. I deplored what they were doing. I deplored the innocent people they were tormenting and traumatizing. I deplored their illegal leaking. I deplored the fact that they knew, once they knew our evidence, that this was a bogus lawsuit and that because of the funding they had from my political enemies, they were putting ahead. I deplored it, but I was determined to walk through the minefield of this deposition without violating the law, and I believe I did.
Later, the president said that the Jones lawyers and the Starr investigation were attempting to criminalize his private life. In addition to these tapes, 2,800 pages of additional evidence was released by the House of Representatives this morning. Neil Conan, NPR News, Washington.
While many Americans focus on the videotape grand jury testimony, Mr. Clinton was addressing the United Nations General Assembly to repeat a call for a united front in combating terrorism. UN delegates gave Mr. Clinton a rousing standing ovation as he prepared to address the world body. Hurricane George barreled into the northeastern Caribbean today with 110-mile-an-hour winds, flooding roads, toppling trees and utility lines, and forcing thousands of people to evacuate their homes. George is headed now for the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, and both of those territories have declared states of emergency and activated National Guard troops to help patrol streets and evacuate residents. The eye of the hurricane is currently located just east of the U.S. Virgin Islands. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial average is down just over 133 points at 7,762. The NASDAQ composite is down 25. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, for stock market investors, the wall of worry seems too high to climb this morning. The U.S. market, as well as stock markets worldwide, are in broad retreat today, as NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Japan set the tone with Nikkei 225 losing nearly 3% of its value today, and European markets and the U.S. stock market are going along for the ride. In Japan, stocks fell on concerns over the viability of a plan to bail out that country's banks. That is ahead of this week's scheduled visit to the U.S. by Japanese Prime Minister Keizo Obuchi. Meantime, all eyes are on Washington, where the release of President Clinton's videotaped grand jury testimony has investors worried over any new revelations that could rock the White House and further endanger the Clinton presidency. In corporate news, Lockheed Martin says it will pay $2.7 billion for satellite company ComSat and five airlines, British Airways American, Cathay Pacific, Canadian Airlines, and Qantas, announced they've reached agreement on a global marketing alliance. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair says he would like to see changes in international financial institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Blair says rapid reform is needed to help the World Bank and the IMF better respond to global financial crises. The head of the Kellogg's Corporation's North American business has resigned after 18 years with the company. Thomas Knowlton is the second vice president of the cereal firm to quit just within the past week. A replacement for him has not yet been named. The Tupperware Corporation says weakness in Latin America and Europe has taken the air out of its profits. The company says it expects to report a modest loss in the third quarter of the year. Analysts had been looking for a slight advance compared to a year earlier. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, working with public libraries to help adults improve their literacy skills.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first modern media superstar is how Charles Lindbergh has been described by his biographer, A. Scott Berg. Lindbergh is most famous for two things. He became a hero in 1927 when he made the first successful flight across the Atlantic. And he became a victim in 1932 after his infant son was kidnapped and killed in what was called the crime of the century. Over the years, Lindbergh and his family worked hard to protect their privacy. Before his death in 1973, he stipulated that his papers should remain private until 50 years after the death of his widow, Anne Morrow Lindbergh. In spite of that, Scott Berg contacted Anne Morrow Lindbergh with a request for access to the family papers for a biography he hoped to write. She was finally so impressed with Berg, she gave him access to her husband's papers and her own. Berg is the author of biographies of editor Maxwell Perkins and film mogul Samuel Goldwyn. I asked Scott Berg to describe why Lindbergh's transatlantic flight was so remarkable in 1927.
Not only was it a fantastically long way to go in a short time. I mean, not only was this the greatest demonstration to date of what aviation could do, but this was really the first moment in which a single human being left the Earth. There was no contact with this one human being. Again, Columbus, many thought, was gonna just float off the edges of the Earth, but he was not alone. Lindbergh was out there alone, and there was that period where he had flown up from, he left from Roosevelt Field in Long Island, he went up to the coast of Canada, and then for about 15 hours, he was flying into just black night, terrible weather, and he was out of visual and audio contact with every human being on Earth. So... this, in that moment, he was suddenly elevated to godlike status. And then, 15 hours later, he is spotted for the first time coming over Ireland and rejoining the human race. And, of course, by the time he did actually land at Le Bourget in Paris, he did become a god in that instant. So it was an act of great, great heroism. It was death-defying, and he pulled it off. And above and beyond that, it was scientifically a wonder in that he who had lost his bearings several times through the flight, his compasses went out because he flew through magnetic storms and so forth, when he finally hit the other side, he was 3 miles off course. So this was just astounding that this could be done. And of course, in the historical sense, he, in that one instant, in that 33.5-hour flight, shrunk the world.
Now, he became quite a celebrity after the flight, and from the way you describe it in your book, it was a combination of things. It was the importance of the feat that he had just accomplished, and it was also the place that he held within the rise of mass media.
Yes, I think that there's no doubt about that. I mean, the accomplishment was fantastic in and of itself, but it was that moment, too, where radio had really reached its maturity, where we had all sorts of processes for sending photographs through cables and so forth. We had motion pictures. And in fact, for the first time, 1927, they were synchronizing sound with film. And in fact, the first sound newsreel was of Lindbergh taking off at Roosevelt Field. So within 2 days, films could be sent around the world, and everybody instantaneously, simultaneously could share in that experience. They could actually see and hear Lindbergh's plane taking off. Now, on top of that, he was one of the most photogenic men who ever lived. In all my research, I've seen thousands, 5,000, 10,000 photographs of Charles Lindbergh. I've never seen one bad shot of him. I mean, he was just impossibly handsome, and he was young. He was 25, and it was at a moment when America was really hitting its stride. You know, it was a few years after World War I where we had really achieved our place in the world. I mean, there we were, having saved the free world and so forth. So here was this fantastic embodiment of America, of youth, and of all the possibilities of aviation.
The media attention, the celebrity, enormously changed Lindbergh's life. And now, I mean, for people who are always in the public eye, one of the questions is, where is that dividing line between private life and public life? And that was an issue for the Lindberghs, too. When Charles Lindbergh met Anne Morrow and they became a couple, there was an enormous amount of public interest in them. Why was there so much interest in them as a couple, and how did they deal with that?
Well, and again, you've really hit on something extremely important, which, because of all this frenzy after Lindbergh's flight, he really did become the first human quarry for the press. We didn't have the phrase paparazzi then, but it was the first time the paparazzi did cross that line. Even movie stars who existed before that, they were protected by studios, and there was a certain code of ethics. And also, people knew the movie stars weren't really the people they portrayed on the screen. Lindbergh was the real thing. So indeed, from that night he landed in Paris, all rules were broken. All rules were thrown out the window, in fact. And he was literally stalked from that day forward. So suddenly, here's this handsome young bachelor who loves his mother, and ultimately he falls in love. It was a kind of storybook meeting with one of the daughters of the American ambassador to Mexico, Dwight Morrow, and this great story unfolded in the press. Everybody loved it. Lindy was falling in love. And he fell in love with a very attractive woman, and she was a poetic woman. I mean, she was really good copy. They looked good together. He was a foot taller than she. He came from the world of science and aviation and machines, and she was this lovely poet. So everything just sort of worked for them. So indeed, the media went crazy for that. It was another thing to sell papers with.
Scott Berg is my guest, and we're talking about his new biography of Charles Lindbergh. Let's get to the kidnapping. You found the nurse, Betty Gao, who cared for the Lindbergh baby and discovered that he was missing.
I did. It was a rather, well, I was going to say rather touching, but it was more than that. It was an extremely dramatic moment when I found her, and she agreed to see me very reluctantly because she really hasn't talked about the Lindbergh case in 65. Well, at that point, it was 60 years she hadn't talked about it. And it was very difficult for her because she was indeed the caretaker of that baby, and so she loved the baby. And she was the first person to discover the baby was missing. But worst of all, she became the first suspect. And for many years, people assumed she had done it or had been in on it. And so her life, I mean, she was just a girl. She was 19 or 20 years old when she came over to this country, a rather shy Scotswoman herself. And suddenly, here her entire life is plastered on the front page of every newspaper in the world. And it petrified her. And ultimately, she went back to Scotland and indeed sought a rather quiet, reclusive life. She just wanted to get back to being herself.
What did you learn from the Lindbergh papers about what went through Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's minds during the period when their child was missing and the hunt was on?
Yes. For me, the most interesting aspect of that period, going through their papers, was to see how it affected the marriage. And I've been told by people who have been through tragedies that it either brings the married couple closer together or it tears them apart. I think in the case of the Lindbergh kidnapping, it did both, actually. during the period while the baby was missing and for the next year or two after that, there was a great kind of foxhole mentality between Charles and Anne that really did bring them together. But after the kidnapping, it was something Lindbergh never wanted to deal with, never talk about. And it always plagued Anne Lindbergh that she never saw her husband cry, that she felt he never properly mourned over this tragedy that had struck both of them, certainly. And as a result of that, she always felt, and in fact a psychiatrist she later saw always felt, that there was this buried trauma there. And it became a kind of wedge, or more than that, it became almost a cancerous growth that got bigger and bigger. And in the later years of the Lindbergh marriage, they were separated for weeks, sometimes months at a time, and never really talked about. And I think, and I think she thinks, that a lot of it goes back to 1932, when this tragedy was never properly dealt with.
Bruno Hauptmann was convicted of the Lindbergh kidnapping. His widow maintained his innocence to the last. And she spent a lot of time trying to convince journalists, often successfully, to reinvestigate, to write stories, and so on. I'm sure you did a little bit of reinvestigating yourself. What did you walk away thinking?
I did, and indeed I spent an afternoon with Mrs. Hauptmann herself, and she agreed to the interview, I think for the reason that she hoped I would join her cause. And in fact, she asked me point blank if I would go to the governor of New Jersey to get him to reopen the case. And indeed, when I met her and when I started this project, it was a fervent hope of mine that I would find enough evidence to clear Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And I really pored over everything I could find with that hope. Unfortunately, the deeper I got into the case and the more I studied the evidence and the more I read the transcripts and everyone's statements and so forth, and I really spent a lot of time on all the evidence, the guiltier he came up.
What did you think his motive was?
I think his motive was money. I don't think he intended to kill the baby. I think that was an accident. I think that happened when he was leaving the child's nursery on the second floor, coming down a ladder. There was a bit of a gap between the window and the ladder. I think he put too much weight on the ladder. He also had the added weight of the baby. The ladder did break. We know that. You can see that it is split. And I think the baby either cracked his head against the wall of the house or actually fell to the ground, was dropped to the ground, and his skull was smashed then. So that part was an accident, but I think what he hoped to gain was $50,000 in ransom, and it would have been neat and clean. He would have returned the baby right away.
My guest is Scott Berg. He's written a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Scott Berg about his new biography of Charles Lindbergh. During part of the period that you were writing and researching your biography of Charles Lindbergh and the kidnapping, which became known as the crime of the century, the O.J. trial was underway, also being billed as the crime of the century. And I can think of a connection between the two trials, the trial of Bruno Hauptmann and the trial of O.J. Simpson, and that's cameras in the courtroom. Tell the story of cameras in the court in the Lindbergh kidnapping trial.
Yes, and I would say, I was writing those chapters while the O.J. trial was going on, and I thought, oh, if all you news people today only really knew, I mean, the real crime and trial of the century really did happen back in the 30s, and indeed, all the models for what went on during the O.J. trial, such as cameras in the courtroom and basically court television. I mean, they didn't have court TV then, but they had court radio, basically. They had radio announcers constantly reporting at noon and doing interviews with people and with experts and so forth. All that began at the Lindbergh trial, as indeed did cameras in the courtroom. There was a camera hidden in the courtroom. It was a stationary camera. It did not move. It was focused on the witness chair. It's a strange thing because it was such a big, bulky camera. It is hard to believe that people didn't know it was there, but nobody ever copped to knowing it was there. And indeed, after a few days of trial testimony, film footage began to appear in movie houses, in theaters, as part of parts of newsreels. And from that moment, the instant they did appear, the judge pulled them and pulled the camera from the courtroom because everyone immediately saw how that film footage could be used to sway certainly the public, and indeed whether that might trickle down to the jury as well, barred though they were from reading newspapers and so forth.
Did it seem to be affecting public opinion?
Oh, there's no question it was affecting public opinion. And Bruno Richard Hauptmann...
In which direction?
Well, it was against Hauptmann, who suffered primarily because, first of all, he was a German immigrant, and he did not have complete mastery of the English language. And, of course, Germans were still considered somewhat suspicious. It wasn't that many years after the First World War. Indeed, immigrants of any kind were always held in some suspicion. So to see and hear Hauptmann, this was troubling. And he had a somewhat bumbling attorney, and so to see him, that didn't play very well. And there, on the other hand, you would see Charles Lindbergh. I mean, just to see Lindbergh himself, who was this bastion and vision of strength and goodness, to see Anne Lindbergh on the stand, this frail, she was still in her 20s when this happened. She was 25 when the crime happened, 28 when the trial occurred. So to see this rather small, frail woman who had obviously been crying, this could not but sway public opinion.
By the way, when you say the camera was hidden in the courtroom, the judge knew it was there, didn't he?
Yes, presumably he did. So it was there that everyone had agreed that a camera could be in the courtroom, but it was not to be used during the actual testimony. That is, when court broke, the camera could be used to film some of the principals. And indeed, some of the attorneys, for example, when court was not in session, would go before the camera and actually reenact some of the things they had said. So that in and of itself contributed to the whole falsity of the operation. And that was yet another reason why cameras were really removed from courtrooms all across the country from that moment on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Berg, and we're talking about his new biography of Charles Lindbergh. Now, you and I were both warned about protecting ourselves against kidnapping as children, largely because of the Lindbergh kidnapping. What impact did the Lindbergh kidnapping have on Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh's approach to protecting their children? What did you get from that, from the papers that you had access to?
Yes, the papers were very revealing in that regard, because Lindbergh was of two minds. On one hand, he was extremely protective, and in fact, he was protective of his family his entire life. It was part of the reason I think he wanted the papers, his own papers, locked up so that nobody could bother his family for 50 years after his death and so forth. But the interesting thing, the flip side, is he was not going to become paranoid about it. And it was as though he was not going to become a victim of the crime twice. And what amazed me is when the second child was born, which was just a few months after the kidnapping, shortly after that, he suddenly took Anne on a trip, a flying trip around the world that lasted for months. So for months at a time, he and Anne suddenly left their baby alone with a nurse or with her mother, sometimes with his mother, but off they went. And it was almost as though he were saying to his wife, this is what I felt rather strongly, we are not going to become paranoid here, and we've got to get on with our lives, and we must just assume this will not happen again. We must protect ourselves as best we can, but that must not change the way we live in a basic way. And off they went. And it was amazing to me that after the birth of each child, Lindbergh did that same drill.
Well, it's almost as if, excuse me for the cheap psychoanalysis here, but it's almost as if what he really was saying was, this time around, we're not going to allow ourselves to become very attached to the infant. We're going to, like, get away and not have this emotional attachment.
I think there's some truth to that. I definitely do. And the Lindbergh children all grew up feeling very loved, but never cosseted by any means. And I think there was always some detachment between parents and children.
You write that your mother didn't want you to write this book about Charles Lindbergh because she thought of Lindbergh as an anti-Semite. And
it was my grandmother.
Your grandmother, excuse me. And therefore, Lindbergh was like not worth the attention. He was a scoundrel, an anti-Semite. What did you find about his degree of anti-Semitism?
Yes, and I will say this. I think my grandmother thought he was worth the attention. I think her real worry was, is that a world I wanted to spend a decade in?
Uh-huh.
My grandmother was Jewish, and she grew up in a time and a place where there was a rather sharp division between Jews and Gentiles, and we don't belong to their clubs and so forth. And I think she was wary of my invading that particular world. What I found was more and less than I expected. And it really became a great exploration for me of what is anti-Semitism. What I learned was that Charles Lindbergh was not an active anti-Semite. He did not hate Jews, if that is your definition of what an anti-Semite is. Some of his best friends were Jewish, as the phrase goes, which is an immediate tip-off to most Jews that he probably is anti-Semitic. But the truth of the matter is, Charles Lindbergh, who didn't have many friends in the world, did have several Jewish friends. He consorted with them, he worked with them, he was friends with them. Now, at the same time, that makes the very point. He did segregate them in his mind. Jews were different. And indeed, during the America First period, which was an extremely controversial period in this country's life, and it was in Lindbergh's life, he did make some references in his writings and in a speech he delivered in which he talked about the Jews as being other than Americans, as being different, as being another category of people. And in saying that, he really went against the grain of the founding fathers. He really defied what this country is about, which is the great melting pot.
Scott Berg is the author of a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Charles Lindbergh's biographer, A. Scott Berg. He was the first person to have access to Lindbergh's private papers. And we meet Lindbergh's youngest daughter, Reeve. She's written a new memoir. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with A. Scott Berg, the author of a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh is best known for making the first transatlantic flight back in 1927. His family was devastated in 1932 by what was described as the crime of the century, the kidnap and killing of the Lindbergh baby. In the late 30s, Lindbergh's heroic image was tarnished by anti-Semitic comments. For example, in a 1938 speech in Des Moines, he said this about Jews: "Their greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government."
And he believed that. And that was, and this is hardly to excuse him, that was a very common thought in the 30s, the 40s, and well into the 50s and 60s, in fact. The Jews control the media. I mean, we have all heard that. Lindbergh actively believed that. And he believed it primarily because he wanted to believe it. He had to believe it.
And adding to his reputation for anti-Semitism, in 1937, he described Hitler as a great man. He said, "I believe Hitler has done much for the German people." And shortly before Kristallnacht, he received a medal from Germany, which he never gave back in protest after the war started and after he realized what was actually going on there. Did he ever change his mind about Hitler after the revelations about the concentration camps and the death camps?
He really didn't. And this is one of the great downfalls, or one of the reasons for the downfall of Charles Lindbergh, too. He stubbornly adhered to everything he ever thought, said, or did. And it was admirable on one hand that he stood by his actions and record. On the other hand, he never came around. His wife did recant. She wrote, I found several things in her diaries that were never published that were indeed praising Hitler, praising Nazi Germany, and so forth. And she did retract them and say, I was really naive or I didn't want to know better. Lindbergh really was infatuated with Germany. One can understand why, and my job is never to excuse him. It's really to explain him. And I try to take you on Lindbergh's journey so that you can see what it is he fell in love with, which was this amazing technological society that was springing forward in the 30s, that had the greatest air force in the world, that seemed to be an anti-crime country and so forth. But of course, he was closing his eyes to the most horrible crimes going on of all. Now, in his defense, there was a lot we did not know about Nazi crimes then. On the other hand, there was plenty we did know. And indeed, he was given this medal, and indeed, he chose never to give it back.
In spite of Lindbergh's many aviation talents and all that he could have offered to the aviation industry during World War II, FDR banned him from participating in any of the government's war efforts. Why?
It's really one of the most interesting things to me, because I grew up a great Roosevelt lover, and I still am. I mean, I think he was a fantastic president. But what I learned putting this book together was really what a petty and manipulative and powerful politician he was at the same time. Lindbergh and Roosevelt became the two great antagonists during the 2 years before Pearl Harbor, 1940, 1941. During that period, Roosevelt very much wanted this country to get into the war. Lindbergh was the primary spokesman to keep us out of the war. And they would give dueling speeches. Roosevelt would give a fireside chat, and some of the country would come over to him. Then Lindbergh would go out and give an address on behalf of America First, and the country would trot toward him. And indeed, as late as the spring and into the summer of 1941, this is now 6 months, and even really up until 3 months before Pearl Harbor, most of the country backed Lindbergh and his position. They believed this was a European war.
America First was an isolationist group.
It was an isolationist organization. When I started the book, in fact, this was one of the great surprises for me. I thought America First was started by a bunch of middle-aged, Midwestern, very Republican senators. What I learned, in fact, was that America First began as a kind of youth movement. It was an organization started by a few students at Yale Law School and Yale University, undergraduates, and a strange conglomeration of kids, basically, who were Gerald Ford, Sergeant Shriver, Potter Stewart, who, of course, ended up on the U.S. Supreme Court, Kingman Brewster, who became president of Yale University. So these were not rabid right-wingers. These were rather idealistic young men who believed, as Lindbergh did, that this was not an American war. Of course, everything changed with Pearl Harbor, and at that moment, Lindbergh tried to get into the war.
So was this FDR's problem with Lindbergh an ideological one, a political
yes,
one?
It was a political problem and ideological, and indeed they had had a skirmish about 7 years earlier over the airmail, and it was a fight over canceling some airmail contracts, and it was a very public fight, and it was one that Lindbergh won, and Franklin Roosevelt had made a mistake. It was his first big public goof in the New Deal. It was in 1934, and as a result of that, he always sort of had it in for Lindbergh.
Now, Lindbergh went on to other technical accomplishments in the latter part of his life. Maybe you can briefly sum up what they were.
Well, actually, his accomplishments were really all across the board for the last 33 years of his life, most interesting of which, I think, was actually anti-technology, which is he became extremely interested in the environment and conservation. And it was quite ironic because Lindbergh himself realized that he was responsible for a lot of the problems in the environment. He, having been the great romantic symbol of aviation, which shrank the world, it occurred to him that he was responsible for a lot of the encroaching of civilization in areas where it shouldn't be encroached upon. As a result of that, animals were becoming extinct. Some remote tribes were becoming extinct, tribes of human beings, the flora, the fauna. And so he really spent the last 25 years of his life as a very active crusader trying to save the planet. He was very big on saving the whales, saving the trees. He said at one point toward the end of his life, if I had to choose between airplanes and birds, I would choose birds. And it was interesting to me, he was on the Pan Am board, and when the supersonic transport was being developed, he vocally and publicly came out against the SST. He just thought it was ecologically unsound and that it was unnecessary. And in fact, he wrote a big op-ed piece in the New York Times on the very subject. And all Lindbergh's life, he always maintained an interest in archaeology and in anthropology. So there were always, whenever I thought I could pin a label on Lindbergh or whenever I thought I knew where he was going, he would fool me. He'd make a right-hand turn and go in an entirely different direction.
I think one thing our society is trying to come to terms with now is the fact that a lot of people who are exceptionally gifted in one way or another, whether it's in the arts or politics, are also very flawed in one way or another, whether it's in certain views that they hold or certain ways they live their private life. And somehow, if you throw fame or celebrity into the equation, it seems to complicate things even more. And I'm wondering if writing the Lindbergh book has given you a chance to reflect on that, and if so, what kinds of conclusions you've been reaching.
Well, it has, and the first and foremost conclusion I've reached is lives are not black and white. And we all live rather gray lives, I think, and that is touched with pastels of other colors, needless to say, but nothing is black and white. Charles Lindbergh knew all along. He knew the morning after when they turned him into a god that he was, in fact, only a man. And he knew nobody could be everything to every man, and he was not. And he felt people kept trying to push him into those slots, and one cannot do that. And that has an application today about President Clinton, for that matter. He is who he is, and you know, we've got to take the whole package or reject the whole package. But that's the case, and that's as it was with Lindbergh. And I learned, for me personally, it was not to be judgmental. My job is not to pass judgment on my subjects. It is to serve up as much information in as dramatic a fashion as I can, that information to the public so you can decide who this person is and you can develop your own feelings about him. But I think after you read the Lindbergh book, you will have mixed feelings from beginning to end. And I think some people who have demonized him will realize he was quite an amazing man. And I think some people who have deified him will realize the same thing, that he is, alas, only a man.
Well, Scott Berg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Scott Berg is the author of a new biography of Charles Lindbergh. We'll meet Lindbergh's youngest child, Reeve Lindbergh, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Reeve Lindbergh, is the youngest child of Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. She was born in 1945. Reeve says she's very pleased with Scott Berg's new biography of her father. She approved the decision to grant Berg access to her father's papers. She thought the time was right to tell her father's story and that Berg was the person to do it. In her new memoir, she tells what it was like to grow up in the Lindbergh family. Her book is titled Under a Wing. Reeve Lindbergh is also the author of children's books and two novels. The new biography of her father says that the Lindbergh children learned in school or through friends about the kidnap and murder of their brother. I asked her how she found out.
I think I found out in a school, it's either in a newsreel at school or maybe even it was through one of those Life magazine retrospective photograph series. And then if I asked questions to my mother, she would talk a little bit about it. I did not even try to ask my father. It seemed like something I shouldn't ask him about.
What signal did he give you that gave you that impression?
He seemed closed on the past. He did not seem to be somebody who could easily talk about the past. And I think it was much more an understood feeling among us that you just didn't ask him than any signal that he gave directly. For me, anyway, it just was something that I knew from earliest childhood. You just don't ask him.
Do you remember what your reaction was when you found out about the kidnapping?
Yeah, I thought I felt very strange. It was almost like a numbing experience, and that still happens. I'll read a reference to the kidnapping in a book. A book I was asked to review, and I can feel it. I just kind of go numb. I don't know why that is. I wonder whether it's some kind of defense against emotion, but it doesn't feel real.
Were you angry with your parents for not telling you themselves?
Oh, no. No, I wasn't. I think I understood it immediately as terribly, terribly painful. And no, I wasn't angry about that, ever.
You write that for years, people would show up at the door of your family's home claiming to be the grown version of the baby who was kidnapped. Did you ever believe any of them, that any of them really was your long-lost brother?
Oh, no, I never believed it. Actually, I think it only happened maybe twice, and each time it seemed very strange, but I never doubted ever that the baby had died. There was probably because in our family that was the strongest sense that we had lost a brother. There was a death in the family, and that really overshadowed the family in certain ways.
Your first baby, you write about this in your memoir, your first baby died at the same age that your brother did, just before reaching his second birthday.
Yeah, it was my first son. My daughters were born, but it was my first little boy.
Mm-hmm. And that was a seizure from encephalitis?
That's right. Yeah.
In the middle of the night while you were sleeping?
Yes, I was sleeping at my mother's house, and he was too, yeah.
And you write how your mother told you to spend some time just sitting with your baby's body.
Yeah.
Why did she suggest that?
I think she must have wished that she could have done it herself. And when her child died, he was, of course, lost for several months before they found the body, and it had been buried in a very shallow grave and in the woods, and there had been animals, and it was not something that she ever saw, that body. So she missed having just the chance to mourn, to be with the child's body, and she told me that I should do that, that it would be important for me to do that. And she sat with me. It was an amazing moment.
It must have made you feel that, babies are just so vulnerable that there's only a certain amount you can do to protect
yes.
a child.
Yes, there it did. And for when my second son was born, it was very hard for me sometimes in the morning to go and check on him because I had found the first one dead unexpectedly. And I do think this happens to people who have lost their children, is that it's so hard not to overprotect and to behave normally toward the next one.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering, you try to keep that impulse in check as a mother yourself. Were you overprotected as a child by your parents?
I don't know. I guess my brothers and my sister said I was spoiled, so I don't know whether that means overprotected or not, but they were pretty much kidding. I think we were certainly very much protected in terms of our surroundings, yes. We were. My father was very, very careful about where we lived and how we lived and who came to the door, and we always had a German Shepherd, which are they're a little intimidating for people coming up out of the blue to visit. We were pretty well protected, but we also had, we went to public schools, and we were encouraged to, you know, ride our bikes and make our friends and run around the neighborhood with everybody else. So I guess the answer would be yes and no.
So do you like to fly?
I used to. I flew with him, and I loved it, but although it was a little noisy. And but I haven't flown as a pilot. I never got a pilot's license. I fly like everybody else, like a commuter, the way we all do. But I loved flying with him early on. Even in the days that I was flying with him, you felt his sense of freedom.
Could you describe a little for us one of those early flights with your father?
Oh, well, the one I wrote about was when we were, every Saturday, or almost, maybe it wasn't even every Saturday, it felt like every Saturday that he was home, he would take us flying out of Danbury, Connecticut. There was a little airport there, and he would take us up, each of us one at a time, and he would give us some flying instruction. But he also, you could tell, he just kind of wanted to give us the feel of what it was like to be up there in the air. And sometimes he would just have fun. You know, he would climb way up with the airplane and then dive, and he would feel the weightlessness. Or he would he'd just kind of go low and show you all the little roads and the cars. And then once, with me, the automatic choke malfunctioned, and we had to put down in a cow pasture. And I had no clue what was happening. I wrote about this, but he said, we have to land because we can't get to the airport in time. And I thought, gee, in time for what? I had no sense of danger at all.
Oh, that's just as well.
It was wild. It was just wild. And then he just said, well, you put your head down now. So I did it. And then I said, are we going to crash? You know, I got all excited. But it wasn't fear, really. I just thought it was an adventure. I don't know what I was thinking. But he got us down in this field, and we bumped along, and you know, we didn't hit any stones or trees, and we didn't hit any cows, and we did fine. And then we, you know, got out and off we went. But he said it was one of the most dangerous forced landings he had. But I, of course, had no notion. I was about 7 years old, and I just thought we were having a good time.
One of the things about your father that Scott Berg brings up in his biography is the period around World War II when your father, for a period, supported Hitler. Before the revelations about the concentration camps, but he never withdrew some of that support. He never spoke out against Hitler after that and seemed to consider Jews the other, so to speak. And I'm wondering if that was new to you, if you were aware of that.
Well, it was new to me. My father always claimed that he didn't at all support Hitler, that he admired the German people and he was an isolationist. He didn't want the U.S. going into war at that time, and of course there were many, many other isolationists. But he did make that Des Moines speech in which, to me, there were three paragraphs that sounded anti-Semitic. And there are those, I still get letters from people who say, no, you're judging him harshly, it wasn't anti-Semitic, it was just the isolationist position. And I try to understand that. But to me, it's very, very hard, having been born after the war, to read that and not feel the anti-Semitic implications of that kind of language.
It must be so strange for you, you know, to have, at the same time as your memoir has come out, this massive biography about your father, and I'm wondering if you have this instinct to be protective of his image or to just be as kind of fair about it as you can, to just, you know, try to learn the truth as a, you know, the good and the bad in the middle, as opposed to just kind of, you know, preserving the image.
Oh, yeah. No, I do. I'm much more interested in both the truth and in the humanity of my family than in any kind of image. I'm not too crazy about images. I think somebody said that image is death. So, and I think you lose humanity in image. And my sense is that Scott also was very much trying to get behind the image and into the story of this man and what happened to him. And I think he's done a really beautiful job. It's a different view. Our views are different a little bit, but not, I think, conflicting. It's funny. It's almost as though I'm looking at him from the inside and Scott is looking at him from the outside, and together you have this picture. And I think it's accurate. It's not always exactly the same, but I think we're both accurate in our views.
What are some of the things that you see from the inside?
Well, I saw he was much more relaxed with me, I think, than he ever would be, would appear to be in a more public context. He was able a little bit to just kind of relax and lay back and have a good time at home more than one felt he could outside of the home. And one of my brothers was just talking to me about this, about how he would, you know, he came back from camp and he was on the train platform and he ran up to throw his arms around my father, and my father sort of turned to stone. He just, and Land realized, oh no, you don't do this in public, as though there was no possibility of displaying affection or, you know, doing anything emotional where anybody could see you. Whereas at home, it seemed much less that way. He seemed much more willing to be affectionate and to be relaxed and so on than ever outside the home. It was as though there were two different emotional worlds for him.
Reeve Lindberg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry. Appreciate it.
Reeve Lindberg's new memoir is called Under a Wing. Coming up, a preview of the new TV season. This is Fresh Air. In addition to news coverage of the Clinton video testimony, TV is presenting something else for viewers this week, the start of the new season. A total of 36 new shows will be unveiled before the fall is over. TV critic David Bianculli has seen some of the new crop and isn't terribly impressed.
A year ago, when I was checking out the new fall shows, there was one new show that stood out that I got really excited about, Ally McBeal, which turned out to be a surprise hit for Fox. 2 years ago, I was most excited about Easy Streets, which lasted about 10 seconds on CBS. 3 years ago, the shows I thought were truly original were Murder One on ABC and American Gothic on CBS, neither of which made it to a second season. So what show am I thrilled about this year? There isn't one. The closest I can come is Felicity, a new youthful drama series from WB, the network that scored big last year with Dawson's Creek. Carrie Russell stars as a high school student who, on graduation day, gets a sweet note from a cute guy who signs her yearbook and impulsively decides to follow him to college in New York City. He finally runs into her while she's getting her student ID photo taken, but the meeting isn't exactly the reunion Felicity had fantasized. Not when he takes the opportunity to introduce her to his girlfriend. It is, however, a real and unexpected enough moment to make Felicity stand out this season as a very good, very watchable show.
Just look at the dot, please.
Is my hair a disaster? Please be honest, because I'm gonna have to live with this picture for the next 4 years, and that's a really long time.
Hey, what are you doing here?
Hi. This is where I'm going. I totally forgot you were going here.
That is so unbelievable. I know this girl from high school. This is Susan.
Felicity,
wow. All right, so I'll see you around.
Felicity probably will be a hit this year, one of three new series I predict will be instant successes. One of the others, NBC's Jessie, stars Christina Applegate of Married with Children as a woman who's single with child. The reason it'll be a top 10 hit, though, is because of its time slot. It's wedged between Friends and Frasier on NBC's Powerhouse Thursday lineup. And the third can't-miss show is a terrible sitcom called Two of a Kind, which leads off ABC's TGIF children's lineup this season. It can't miss, even though it deserves to, because it stars those awful Olsen twins from Full House. Sometimes, the TV we get is the TV we deserve. Of the other new shows on the schedule, I can recommend four as worth sampling. The 70s Show, a period sitcom that's already running Sunday nights on Fox, is inventive and interesting enough to try. So is Buddy Farrow, the new CBS comedy drama starring Dennis Farina as a once legendary detective still hanging on to his Rat Pack-era sensibilities. And ABC's Sports Night, a kind of ESPN version of the Larry Sanders Show, is smart enough to visit at least once. Finally, there's a show I know I'm going to get grief for enjoying and recommending. ABC's remake of Fantasy Island. I know, go ahead and laugh. I'll wait. You through now? Here's the difference. This new version is a lot darker and a lot smarter. I know, it couldn't be any dumber. But this one stars Malcolm McDowell as Mr. Rourke and comes from Barry Sonnenfeld, who just did Maximum Bob for ABC and was responsible for both movie versions of The Addams Family. And there's no tattoo this time. Another big plus. When a remake of a horrible 20-year-old TV show is one of the highlights of the 1998-99 season, that's a pretty good indication that it's a pretty bad year for new series. The good news, and we need it, is that most of the good old stuff is back. Ally McBeal, Homicide: Life on the Street, The Simpsons, The Practice, Frasier. Those are the shows to watch this year.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape by the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.